If there's anything I can do, believe me. Oh, I love young people. I'm in love with young people. The younger generation are the one prop of our suffering country. Her one hope. Oh, go, go. But Piotr Ilyich had already run away, or she would not have let him go so soon. Yet Madame Holokov had made a rather agreeable impression on him, which had somewhat softened his anxiety at being drawn into such an unpleasant affair. Tastes differ, as we all know. She's by no means so elderly, he thought, feeling pleased. On the contrary, I should have taken her for her daughter. As for Madame Holokov, she was simply enchanted by the young man. Such sense, such exactness. In so young a man. In our day. And all that with such manners and appearance. People say the young people of today are no good for anything. But here's an example. Etc. So she simply forgot this dreadful affair, and it was only as she was getting into bed, that, suddenly recalling how near death she had been, she exclaimed, "Ah, it is awful, awful." But she fell at once into a sound, sweet sleep. I would not, however, have dwelt on such trivial and irrelevant details, if this eccentric meeting of the young official with the by no means elderly widow had not subsequently turned out to be the foundation of the whole career of that practical and precise young man. His story is remembered to this day with amazement in our town, and I shall perhaps have something to say about it, when I have finished my long history of the brothers Karamazov. Chapter 2, The Alamar Police Captain, Mikhail Makarovich Makarov, a retired lieutenant, colonel, was a widower and an excellent man. He had only come to us 3 years previously, but had won general esteem, chiefly because he knew how to keep society together. He was never without visitors, and could not have got on without them. Someone or other was always dining with him. He never sat down to table without guests. He gave regular dinners, too, on all sorts of occasions, sometimes most surprising ones. Though the fare was not recherché, it was abundant. The fish, pies were excellent, and the wine made up in quantity for what it lacked in quality. The first room his guests entered was a well-fitted billiard room, with pictures of English race horses, in black frames on the walls, an essential decoration, as we all playing every evening at his house, if only at one table. But at frequent intervals, all the society of our town, with the mamas and young ladies, assembled at his house to dance. Mikhail Makarovich was a widower. He did not live alone. His widow daughter lived with him, with her two unmarried daughters, grown-up girls, who had finished their education. They were of agreeable appearance and lively character, and though everyone knew they would have no dowry, they attracted all the young men of fashion to their grandfather's house. Mikhail Makarovich was by no means very efficient in his work, though he performed his duties no worse than many others. To speak plainly, he was a man of rather narrow education. His understanding of the limits of his administrative power could not always be relied upon. It was not so much that he failed to grasp certain reforms enacted during the present reign, as that he made conspicuous blunders in his interpretation of them. This was not from any special lack of intelligence, but from carelessness, for he was always into greater hurry to go into the subject. "I have the heart of a soldier rather than of a civilian," he used to say of himself. He had not even formed a definite idea of the fundamental principles of the reforms connected with the emancipation of the serfs, and only picked it up, so to speak, from year to year, involuntarily increasing his knowledge by practice. And yet he was himself a landowner. Piotr Ilyich knew for certain that he would meet some of Mikhail Makarovich's visitors there that evening, but he didn't know which. As it happened, at that moment the prosecutor, and Varvinsky, our district doctor, a young man, who had only just come to us from Petersburg after taking a brilliant degree at the Academy of Medicine, were playing whist at the police captain's. Ippolit Kirillovich, the prosecutor. He was really the deputy prosecutor, but we always called him the prosecutor, was rather a peculiar man, of about 35, inclined to be consumptive, and married to a fat and childless woman. He was vain and irritable, though he had a good intellect, and even a kind heart. It seemed that all that was wrong with him was that he had a better opinion of himself than his ability warranted. And that made him seem constantly uneasy. He had, moreover, certain higher, even artistic, leanings, towards psychology, for instance, a special study of the human heart, a special knowledge of the criminal and his crime. He cherished a grievance on this ground, considering that he had been passed over in the service, and being firmly persuaded that in higher spheres he had not been properly appreciated, and had enemies. In gloomy moments he even threatened to give up his post, and practice as a barrister in criminal cases. The unexpected calmness of case agitated him profoundly. It was a case that might well be talked about all over Russia. But I am anticipating. Nikolay Parfenovich Nelyudov, the young investigating lawyer, who had only come from Petersburg 2 months before, was sitting in the next room with the young ladies. People talked about it afterwards and wondered that all the gentlemen should, as though intentionally, on the evening of the crime have been gathered together at the house of the executive authority. Yet it was perfectly simple and happened quite naturally. Ippolit Kirillovich's wife had had toothache for the last 2 days, and he was obliged to go out to escape from her groans. The doctor, from the very nature of his being, could not spend an evening except at cards. Nikolay Parfenovich Nelyudov had been intending for 3 days past to drop in that evening at Mihail Makarovich's, so to speak casually, so as slyly to startle the eldest granddaughter, Olga Mihailovna, by showing that he knew her secret, that he knew it was her birthday, and that she was trying to conceal it on purpose, so as not to be obliged to give a dance. He anticipated a great deal of merriment, many playful jests about her age, and her being afraid to reveal it, about his knowing her secret and telling everybody, and so on. The charming young man was a great adept at such teasing. The ladies had christened him the Naughty Man, and he seemed to be delighted at the name. He was extremely well bred, however, of good family, education and feelings, and, though leading a life of pleasure, his sallies were always innocent and in good taste. He was short, and delicate, looking. On his white, slender, little fingers he always wore a number of big, glittering rings. When he was engaged in his official duties, he always became extraordinarily grave, as though realizing his position and the sanctity of the obligations laid upon him. He had a special gift for mystifying murderers and other criminals of the peasant class during interrogation, and if he did not win their respect, he certainly succeeded in arousing their wonder. Pyotr Ilyich was simply dumbfounded when he went into the police captain's. He saw instantly that everyone knew. They had positively thrown down their cards, all were standing up and talking. Even Nikolay Parfenovich had left the young ladies and run in, looking strenuous and ready for action. Pyotr Ilyich was met with the astounding news that old Fyodor Pavlovich really had been murdered that evening in his own house, murdered and robbed. The news had only just reached them in the following manner. Marfa Ignatievna, the wife of old Grigory, who had been knocked senseless near the fence, was sleeping soundly in her bed and might well have slept till morning after the draught she had taken. But, all of a sudden she waked up, no doubt roused by a fearful epileptic scream from Smerdyakov, who was lying in the next room unconscious. That scream always preceded his fits, and always terrified and upset Marfa Ignatievna. She could never get accustomed to it. She jumped up and ran half awake to Smerdyakov's room. But it was dark there, and she could only hear the invalid beginning to gasp and struggle. Then Marfa Ignatievna herself screamed out and was going to call her husband, but suddenly realized that when she had got up, he was not beside her in bed. She ran back to the bedstead and began groping with her hands, but the bed was really empty. Then he must have gone out where? She ran to the steps and timidly called him. She got no answer, of course, but she caught the sound of groans far away in the garden in the darkness. She listened. The groans were repeated, and it was evident they came from the garden. Good Lord! Just as it was with Lizaveta Smerdyashchaya. she thought distractedly. She went timidly down the steps and saw that the gate into the garden was open. He must be out there, poor dear, she thought. She went up to the gate and all at once she distinctly heard Grigory calling her by name, Marfa. Marfa. In a weak, moaning, dreadful voice. Lord, preserve us from harm. Marfa Ignatna murmured, and ran towards the voice, and that was how she found Grigory. But she found him not by the fence where he had been knocked down, but about 20 paces off. It appeared later, that he had crawled away on coming to himself, and probably had been a long time getting so far, losing consciousness several times. She noticed at once that he was covered with blood, and screamed at the top of her voice. Grigory was muttering incoherently, he has murdered. His father murdered. Why scream, silly? Run. Fetch someone. But Marfa continued screaming, and seeing that her master's window was open and that there was a candle alight in the window, she ran there and began calling Fyodor Pavlovich. But peeping in at the window, she saw a fearful sight. Her master was lying on his back, motionless, on the floor. His light, colored dressing, gown and white shirt were soaked with blood. The candle on the table brightly lighted up the blood and the motionless dead face of Fyodor Pavlovich. Terror, stricken, Marfa rushed away from the window, ran out of the garden, drew the bolt of the big gate and ran headlong by the back way to the neighbor, Maria Kondratyevna. Both mother and daughter were asleep, but they waked up at Marfa's desperate and persistent screaming and knocking at the shutter. Marfa, shrieking and screaming incoherently, managed to tell them the main fact, and to beg for assistance. It happened that Foma had come back from his wanderings and was staying the night with them. They got him up immediately and all three ran to the scene of the crime. On the way, Maria Kondratyevna remembered that at about 8 o'clock she heard a dreadful scream from their garden, and this was no doubt Grigory's scream, parricide. Uttered when he caught hold of Mitya's leg. Some one person screamed out and then was silent, Maria Kondratyevna explained as she ran. Running to the place where Grigory lay, the two women with the help of Foma carried him to the lodge. They lighted a candle and saw that Smerdyakov was no better, that he was writhing in convulsions, his eyes fixed in a squint, and that foam was flowing from his lips. They moistened Grigory's forehead with water mixed with vinegar, and the water revived him at once. He asked immediately, "Is the master murdered?" Then Foma and both the women ran to the house and saw this time that not only the window, but also the door into the garden was wide open, though Fyodor Pavlovich had for the last week locked himself in every night and did not allow even Grigory to come in on any pretext. Seeing that door open, they were afraid to go into Fyodor Pavlovich for fear anything should happen afterwards. And when they returned to Grigory, the old man told them to go straight to the police captain. Maria Kondratyevna ran there and gave the alarm to the whole party at the police captain's. She arrived only 5 minutes before Pyotr Ilyich, so that his story came, not as his own surmise and theory, but as the direct confirmation by a witness, of the theory held by all, as to the identity of the criminal, a theory he had in the bottom of his heart refused to believe till that moment. It was resolved to act with energy. The deputy police inspector of the town was commissioned to take 4 witnesses, to enter Fyodor Pavlovich's house and there to open an inquiry on the spot, according to the regular forms, which I will not go into here. The district doctor, a zealous man, new to his work, almost insisted on accompanying the police captain, the prosecutor, and the investigating lawyer. I will note briefly that Fyodor Pavlovich was found to be quite dead, with his skull battered in. But with what? Most likely with the same weapon with which Grigory had been attacked. And immediately that weapon was found, Grigory, to whom all possible medical assistance was at once given, described in a weak and breaking voice how he had been knocked down. They began looking with a lantern by the fence and found the brass vessel dropped in a most conspicuous place on the garden path. There were no signs of disturbance in the room where Fyodor Pavlovich was lying. But by the bed, behind the screen, they picked up from the floor a big and thick envelope with the inscription, a present of 3,000 rubles for my angel Grushenka, if she is willing to come. And below had been added by Fyodor Pavlovich, for my little chicken. There were three seals of red sealing, wax on the envelope, but it had been torn open and was empty, the money had been removed. They found also on the floor a piece of narrow pink ribbon, with which the envelope had been tied up. One piece of Piotr Ilyich's evidence made a great impression on the prosecutor and the investigating magistrate, namely, his idea that Dmitri Fyodorovich would shoot himself before daybreak, that he had resolved to do so, had spoken of it to Ilyich, had taken the pistols, loaded them before him, written a letter, put it in his pocket, etc. When Piotr Ilyich, though still unwilling to believe in it, threatened to tell someone so as to prevent the suicide, Mitya had answered grinning, "You'll be too late. So they must make haste to Mokro to find the criminal, before he really did shoot himself." "That's clear, that's clear," repeated the prosecutor in great excitement. "That's just the way with mad fellows like that. I shall kill myself too, morrow, so I'll make merry till I die." The story of how he had bought the wine and provisions excited the prosecutor more than ever. "Do you remember the fellow that murdered a merchant called Olsafayev, gentlemen? He stole 1,500, went at once to have his hair curled, and then, without even hiding the money, carrying it almost in his hand in the same way, he went off to the girls. All were delayed, however, by the inquiry, the search, and the formalities, etc., in the house of Fyodor Pavlovich. It all took time, and so, 2 hours before starting, they sent on ahead to Mokro the officer of the rural police, Mvreki Mvrekaevich Shmatsov, who had arrived in the town the morning before to get his pay. He was instructed to avoid raising the alarm when he reached Mokro, but to keep constant watch over the criminal till the arrival of the proper authorities, to procure also witnesses for the arrest, police constables, and so on. Mvreki Mvrekaevich did as he was told, preserving his incognito, and giving no one but his old acquaintance, Trifon Borisovich, the slightest hint of his secret business. He had spoken to him just before Mitya met the landlord in the balcony, looking for him in the dark, and noticed at once a change in Trifon Borisovich's face and voice. So neither Mitya nor anyone else knew that he was being watched. The box with the pistols had been carried off by Trifon Borisovich and put in a suitable place. Only after 4 o'clock, almost at sunrise, all the officials, the police captain, the prosecutor, the investigating lawyer, drove up in two carriages, each drawn by three horses. The doctor remained at Fyodor Pavlovich's to make a post-mortem next day on the body. But he was particularly interested in the condition of the servant, Smerdyakov. Such violent and protracted epileptic fits, recurring continually for 24 hours, are rarely to be met with, and are of interest to science, he declared enthusiastically to his companions, and as they left they laughingly congratulated him on his find. The prosecutor and the investigating lawyer distinctly remembered the doctor's saying that Smerdyakov could not outlive the night. After these long, but I think necessary explanations, we will return to that moment of our tale at which we broke off. Chapter 3, The Sufferings of a Soul. The first ordeal, and so Mitya sat looking wildly at the people round him, not understanding what was said to him. Suddenly he got up, flung up his hands, and shouted aloud, "I'm not guilty. I'm not guilty of that blood. I'm not guilty of my father's blood. I meant to kill him. But I'm not guilty. Not I." But he had hardly said this, before Grushenka rushed from behind the curtain and flung herself at the police captain's feet. "It was my fault. Mine. My wickedness," she cried, in a heart-rending voice, bathed in tears, stretching out her clasped hands towards them. "He did it through me. I tortured him and drove him to it. I tortured that poor old man that's dead, too, in my wickedness, and brought him to this. It's my fault, mine first, mine most. My fault. Yes, it's your fault. You're the chief criminal. You fury. You harlot. You're the most to blame. shouted the police captain, threatening her with his hand. But he was quickly and resolutely suppressed. The prosecutor positively seized hold of him. "This is absolutely irregular, Mihail Makarovich," he cried. "You are positively hindering the inquiry. You're ruining the case." He almost gasped. "Follow the regular course. Follow the regular course," cried Nikolay Parfenovich, fearfully excited too, "otherwise it's absolutely impossible. Judge us together." Grushenka cried frantically, still kneeling. "Punish us together. I will go with him now, if it's to death. Grushaw, my life, my blood, my holy one." Mitya fell on his knees beside her and held her tight in his arms. "Don't believe her," he cried, "she's not guilty of anything, of any blood, of anything." He remembered afterwards that he was forcibly dragged away from her by several men, and that she was led out, and that when he recovered himself he was sitting at the table. Beside him and behind him stood the men with metal plates. Facing him on the other side of the table sat Nikolay Parfenovich, the investigating lawyer. He kept persuading him to drink a little water out of a glass that stood on the table. "That will refresh you, that will calm you. Be calm, don't be frightened," he added, extremely politely. Mitya, he remembered it afterwards, became suddenly intensely interested in his big rings, one with an amethyst, and another with a transparent bright yellow stone, of great brilliance. And long afterwards he remembered with wonder how those rings had riveted his attention through all those terrible hours of interrogation, so that he was utterly unable to tear himself away from them and dismiss them, as things that had nothing to do with his position. On Mitya's left side, in the place where Maximov had been sitting at the beginning of the evening, the prosecutor was now seated, and on Mitya's right hand, where Grushenka had been, was a rosy, cheeked young man in a sort of shabby hunting jacket, with ink and paper before him. This was the secretary of the investigating lawyer, who had brought him with him. The police captain was now standing by the window at the other end of the room, beside Kalganov, who was sitting there. "Drink some water," said the investigating lawyer softly, for the tenth time. "I have drunk it, gentlemen, I have. But come, gentlemen, crush me, punish me, decide my fate," cried Mitya, staring with terribly fixed wide, open eyes at the investigating lawyer. "So you positively declare that you are not guilty of the death of your father, Fyodor Pavlovich?" asked the investigating lawyer, softly but insistently. "I am not guilty. I am guilty of the blood of another old man, but not of my father's. And I weep for it. I killed the old man and knocked him down. But it's hard to have to answer for that murder with another, a terrible murder of which I am not guilty. It's a terrible accusation, gentlemen, a knockdown blow. But who has killed my father? Who has killed him? Who can have killed him if I didn't? It's marvelous, extraordinary, impossible. Yes, who can have killed him?" The investigating lawyer was beginning, but Ippolit Kirillovich, the prosecutor, glancing at him, addressed Mitya. "You need not worry yourself about the old servant, Grigory Vasilievich. He is alive, he has recovered, and in spite of the terrible blows inflicted, according to his own and your evidence, by you, there seems no doubt that he will live, so the doctor says, at least." "Alive? He's alive?" cried Mitya, flinging up his hands. His face beamed. "Lord, I thank thee for the miracle thou has wrought for me, a sinner and evildoer. That's an answer to my prayer. I've been praying all night." And he crossed himself three times. He was almost breathless. "So from this Grigory we have received such important evidence concerning you, that—" the prosecutor would have continued, but Mitya suddenly jumped up from his chair. "One minute, gentlemen, for God's sake, one minute, I will run to her. Excuse me, at this moment it's quite impossible," Nikolay Parfenovich almost shrieked. He, too, leapt to his feet. Mitya was seized by the men with the metal plates, but he sat down of his own accord. "Gentlemen, what a pity. I wanted to see her for one minute only, I wanted to tell her that it has been washed away, it has gone, that blood that was weighing on my heart all night, and that I am not a murderer now. Gentlemen, she is my betrothed," he said ecstatically and reverently, looking round at them all. "Oh, thank you, gentlemen. Oh, in 1 minute you have given me new life, new heart. That old man used to carry me in his arms, gentlemen. He used to wash me in the tub when I was a baby 3 years old, abandoned by everyone. He was like a father to me. And so you," the investigating lawyer began. "Allow me, gentlemen, allow me 1 minute more," interposed Mitya, putting his elbows on the table and covering his face with his hands. "Let me have a moment to think, let me breathe, gentlemen. All this is horribly upsetting, horribly. A man is not a drum, gentlemen." "Drink a little more water," murmured Nikolay Parfenovich. Mitya took his hands from his face and laughed. His eyes were confident. He seemed completely transformed in a moment. His whole bearing was changed. He was once more the equal of these men, with all of whom he was acquainted, as though they had all met the day before, when nothing had happened, at some social gathering. We may note in passing that, on his first arrival, Mitya had been made very welcome at the police captain's, but later, during the last month especially, Mitya had hardly called at all, and when the police captain met him, in the street, for instance, Mitya noticed that he frowned and only bowed out of politeness. His acquaintance with the prosecutor was less intimate, though he sometimes paid his wife, a nervous and fanciful lady, visits of politeness, without quite knowing why, and she always received him graciously and had, for some reason, taken an interest in him up to the last. He had not had time to get to know the investigating lawyer, though he had met him and talked to him twice, each time about the fair sex. "You're a most skillful lawyer, I see, Nikolay Parfenovich," cried Mitya, laughing gaily, "but I can help you now. Oh, gentlemen, I feel like a new man, and don't be offended at my addressing you so simply and directly. I'm rather drunk, too, I'll tell you that frankly. I believe I've had the honor and pleasure of meeting you, Nikolay Parfenovich, at my kinsman Musov's. Gentlemen, gentlemen, I don't pretend to be on equal terms with you. I understand, of course, in what character I am sitting before you. Oh, of course, there's a horrible suspicion hanging over me. If Grigory has given evidence. A horrible suspicion. It's awful, awful, I understand that. But to business, gentlemen, I am ready, and we will make an end of it in 1 moment, for, listen, listen, gentlemen. Since I know I'm innocent, we can put an end to it in a minute. Can't we? Can't we?" Mitya spoke much and quickly, nervously and effusively, as though he positively took his listeners to be his best friends. "So, for the present, we will write that you absolutely deny the charge brought against you," said Nikolay Parfenovich, impressively, and bending down to the secretary he dictated to him in an undertone what to write. "Write it down? You want to write that down? Well, write it, I consent, I give my full consent, gentlemen, only. Do you see? Stay, stay, write this. Of disorderly conduct I am guilty, of violence on a poor old man I am guilty. And there is something else at the bottom of my heart, of which I am guilty, too, but that you need not write down," he turned suddenly to the secretary, "that's my personal life, gentlemen, that doesn't concern you, the bottom of my heart, that's to say. But of the murder of my old father I'm not guilty. That's a wild idea. It's quite a wild idea. I will prove you that and you'll be convinced directly. You will laugh, gentlemen. You'll laugh yourselves at your suspicion. Be calm, Dmitri Fyodorovich," said the investigating lawyer, evidently trying to allay Mitya's excitement by his own composure. "Before we go on with our inquiry, I should like, if you will consent to answer, to hear you confirm the statement that you disliked your father, Fyodor Pavlovich, that you were involved in continual disputes with him. Here at least, a quarter of an hour ago, you exclaimed that you wanted to kill him." "I didn't kill him, you said, but I wanted to kill him. Did I exclaim that? Look, that may be so, gentlemen. Yes, unhappily, I did want to kill him.